My name is Mike Barrow, and you're listening to the CPR Podcast. Today, we are going to be rolling out the first in a multi-part series called Protecting Our Own, dealing primarily with treating first responders as patients. Today, we're going to be talking about the injured police officer. If you've been watching the news at all over the last 2 weeks, there are 8 police officers that I am aware of that have died in the line of duty. If you just mind joining me for just a brief moment of silence, thanking them for their sacrifice to their communities. I don't think any of us can ignore that this is a growing trend nationwide. Whether it's distracted drivers on phones rolling up on scenes of accidents and rubbernecking, checking out what exactly is happening and striking one of the first responders with their vehicles, or police-involved shootings, or just attacks on emergency personnel in general. I think this is a trend that's growing nationally and internationally, and I think we need to start preparing a little bit better for that. So if you indulge me for just a second, I'm going to be playing you a short clip, and we'll be talking about it here in just a second.
Okay, that unit was 827 yellow, unit with bell, so you guys might look for bell.
Shots fired, shots fired!
Okay, shots fired, again, shots fired, 2839th, and a culvert.
Prison and Canyon, go to your left, look for the drainage area. Yeah, right in there, look in there, there's an officer coming out.
Okay, so shots fired in the drainage.
Hit 1199, go 12.
Okay, 1199, code
12. Get out!
Okay, again,
1199, 2839. Last
unit, go ahead.
We're gonna need the Bearcat down here now, code 3, let's go.
Okay, code 3 for the Bearcat, code 3. 1199, 2839.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm talking north of the 805 on ITAC 9, I believe. North of the 805.
Oh, on the ground.
Police one.
Able, go ahead.
Need medics to make it to the south end of 38. Police one, are you copying? Tower, police one, are you copying us?
Hey.
I'm going to go ahead and stop it there. If you're anything like me, there's a pit in the bottom of your stomach just listening to that, whether or not you're at work right now. Take a second. Feel your heart rate. I know mine was pretty elevated, and I'm not just chalking it up to being fat and out of shape. I genuinely believe that anytime we hear of these situations, there's an element of subconscious stress that just starts to affect the way we behave, the way we perform, and the way we care for our patients. I think the first enemy that we have to deal with isn't the perpetrator on the scene. It's in our own head. And I think that there are some practical ways that we can begin to combat some of our own stress. So before you even make it to the scene, I think that there are two very, very simple things that we can do to defeat a little bit of the stress before it really starts to kick in. And the first one is simply tactical breathing. I know Mike Loria in episode 9, when he was talking about making decisions under stress, began to discuss some of the military training that he had in tactical breathing. If you look at the show notes for this episode, there's a PDF that we have attached to it that literally walks you through the simple steps of tactical breathing. Taking a breath in for 4 seconds, holding it for 4 seconds, letting it out for 4 seconds, and then waiting again for another 4 seconds before you even take another breath. It's a simple, simple thing that you can do on the way to a run or even on scene to slow your mind down, slow your body down, and it actually will start helping clear up some of your decision-making capabilities. Don't underestimate the power stress has over your actions. Secondly, developing a primary plan with your partner before you even get on scene. Obviously, these situations evolve very quickly, and so the information you get on the way to the run isn't necessarily going to be the information you're going to be acting on once you get there. But if you have a bit of an idea of what you need to get done before you even get there, I think you're a lot less likely to be swept away in the chaos of the situation. While you're rolling up on scene, it's crucial to remember that there are absolutely hazards everywhere. Obviously, if you're rolling up on an MVC that an officer has been involved in, there really isn't a lot different than any other MVC. You're still going to be looking for wires down. You're still going to be looking for fluids that have been spilled, any hazmat situations, doing your primary assessments, of what kind of resources you're going to need to get that officer out of his vehicle or to care for the officer that you would for typically any MVC. So I'm not really going to belabor that subject too much more. This is a situation that you're going to be constantly checking for other patients. I think we're all very tunnel visioned when we hear that one of our coworkers has been injured to rush straight to their aid. And this is a scene that I think has the potential to make you a very unpopular person, but I think we still need to do the right thing. I don't know if many of us really consider the multiple patient scenario with an officer involved in an MVC and still needing to actually do triage. I think that we need to be open-minded to care for the most critically injured person first. And just understand that this is going to be a tough decision for you to make, especially if the officer isn't the one that's injured the worst. Moving on to the officer-involved shooting, just remember that if there's a perpetrator that's still on the loose, that could still potentially be a hazard to the scene. You have no idea if it was an ambush, if it was an isolated incident, and the quickest way to get yourself hurt is by having extended scene time. These types of incidents always seem to draw some sort of crowd, whether there are a bunch of bystanders that are just curious about what's happening, or if there are other responding firefighters, police officers, medics. Everyone wants to be in the middle of what's going on. And so the worst thing that we can have are a bunch of people standing around growing restless. I think when you have other medics that are on scene that you haven't delegated a job to, I think we have this innate ability to think that we can handle the situation better than the person that's actually performing it. And there tends to be a little bit of cynicism and criticism that gets to be thrown around on these scenes, I think just due to the stress level that everybody is experiencing. And I think the best way to avoid crowds are A, getting off scene, and by delegating. If you have somebody that you feel like is just standing there, don't be afraid to ask them to start doing something for you. I think a little bit of crowd participation has a tendency to quell a lot of potential downsides that there are on these scenes. If I haven't harped on it enough, I think scene times are very important in these situations. Typically, if you stop and think about any situation that you may have been involved in, and when there's a delay, you have a tendency to feel like the person that is taking lead on these runs isn't moving quick enough or doesn't appreciate the gravity of that situation. So when you have a bunch of amped up first responders that feels like you aren't moving fast enough, it's just a bad situation overall. And secondly, there's the trauma aspect. Obviously, if you have a shooting or a bad car accident, you just need to move faster. It's a surgical disease. Starting a line on scene really isn't going to do you a lot of favors in the long run. You just need to get that person to a trauma center. And lastly, before we start delving into the initial assessment of an injured officer, we just want to remind everyone here that whatever kind of scene you're on, this is now officially a crime scene. And we don't need to be throwing our first in bag down on the murder weapon. You would be surprised at the dumb stuff we do when we're under stress. Everything you touch, everything you look at is evidence until proven otherwise. So if you can minimize the amount of stuff that you have to cut off or minimize the amount of things you have to move around to get your patient off scene, we would highly advise that you do that. Obviously, if it's getting in the way of patient care and you need to do a rapid intervention to keep someone alive, obviously that takes precedent. But just be mindful of your surroundings whenever you're there. All right, moving on to the actual care of the patient. If you're not in the habit of stripping down your trauma patients, I think this is a good situation to start getting into that habit. There are things that are gonna show up 5, 10, 15 minutes into the run that probably weren't there right away, or complaints that the patient's gonna start having that they didn't have when they first started there just because of the sheer adrenaline involved. Once your patient starts to calm down, they start to get sore, they start to complain of different things that you probably would have missed had you not stripped your patient down. So just be thorough in your initial assessment. If there's any suspect of a gunshot wound, your patient needs to be naked, period, end of statement. You need to be investigating any entrance, exits, or any complications that this person needs to be having. Any major trauma needs to be naked. I'm getting off my soapbox now. I'm a firm believer that duty belts and vests don't belong in the back of an ambulance. They just inhibit you from doing what you need to do, whether it's CPR on the arrested patient, whether it's needle decompression, somebody that has a pneumonia, doesn't really matter. it's going to get in the way of what you need to do. You can't very well put a pelvic binder on an officer that still has his duty belt on, or fully immobilize somebody on a spine board if you have to do that, or place a tourniquet on their leg when their duty belt's just sitting right where you need to just crank down on that tourniquet. They just get in the way, they present further complications down the road, and they just need to come off as soon as you can get them off. There are some special trauma considerations that we really do need to start thinking about. If you take the officer that has just experienced a shooting to center mass, even if they had their ballistic vest on and it absorbed the actual bullet itself, don't underestimate the effect that blunt trauma can have on the heart. There's a study that we did post in the show notes talking about dysrhythmias caused from blunt trauma that I think if you have some extra time, go ahead and peruse through it. It's great. We need to be more mindful of actually taking into consideration what blunt trauma to the chest can do to the heart. And any internal hemorrhage that you could have, you can still get a pneumothorax or experience cardiac tamponade or abdominal compartment hemorrhage from blunt trauma. And I think it's time that we need to start taking that a little bit more seriously in our initial assessment of the injured officer from blunt trauma. It's important to remember that we need to be monitoring our patients, whether it's from blunt trauma or just from the sheer sympathetic dump that they experience in these situations. Just get in the practice of keeping a heart monitor on your officer. There's also a link in the show notes for those of you who have never done it before or haven't done it in a really long time of how to pack a wound, when to pack a wound, different techniques that you can use with that. If you have 5 minutes today, go ahead and look through it. Great information. I wanted to take a brief second to just express that there are a few commercial devices in our show notes. We don't have any conflicts of interest. We're not taking money from anybody. They're just really good explanations of how to walk through a procedure. There are a few extra special considerations that I think are very important to at least touch on. And the first one being that most officers do carry a backup weapon, whether it's an ankle holster, a holster on their armpit, a tactical knife that they have. It's really important to make sure that they have all their weapons off of them before we get them in the back of the truck. And the reason being is that accidents happen. The last thing we want is, if we're treating an unresponsive officer that suddenly regains consciousness, the last thing that they're going to remember was that they were involved in the fight of their life. And they're automatically going to kind of take up where they left off. And by reaching for that backup piece or by still having weapons available for them, I think it's just an accident waiting to happen. And I don't think it's of anybody's fault necessarily. I just think it's just a precautionary step that we can take. And please, if you don't know how to properly disarm somebody or just remove a duty belt, have another officer do it. There's no reason to be John Wayne. There's no reason to accidentally harm somebody else or yourself by trying to do this. So rule of thumb, have another officer try to secure the weapon or any devices that this officer might have, especially when you don't know what you're doing. And I would genuinely say that probably 99% of us really don't. One thing to maybe talk to some of the officers that you know about is carrying just some basic demographics, maybe on the inside of their vest, whether it's a full name, date of birth, what kind of medical history they have, what type of blood they have. Just some basic information that we can be able to utilize for more rapid treatment. Obviously, it's not essential, but it could be helpful. We can't begin to stress the importance of interdepartmental training. I know that the majority of fire services do provide first responders, whether EMTs, paramedics, ALS rigs, BLS rigs, it doesn't really matter. Typically, fire will almost always show up on these types of scenes. It's super important to train together if we want to have good outcomes in these really stressful circumstances. I think it's really important to, while preparing for these types of situations, to not always have a happy ending. I think we need to begin to inoculate ourselves to the best of our ability to plan for the worst and prepare for the worst, because when we don't have a plan going into a situation, we sink back to the level of our training. And if we haven't been training for high stress situations, we're not going to perform very well. I think we owe it to each other to be the best that we can be under these circumstances, and that starts with our training. That starts with how we prepare day in and day out. Even though these are low incident situations, I think we need to be making a bigger deal about preparing for them. We're going to be going into more depth in later episodes, but let us know what you think. Let us know how you guys are preparing and training for these types of situations. Go ahead and leave your comments in the show notes, cprpodcast.org, episode 15. Download this on iTunes, Podcast Republic, Podcast Addicts. Check us out on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Google+. Let us know what you think. We really believe that this should be a higher priority in most departments, and I think we can enact some good change by starting to practice and train together. Our thanks again to Casey Cassidy for all of his help and involvement in this, and we hope you guys have a great Wednesday.